All right, there. I think we're ready to roll here. I want to begin in a sense where I left off the last time I spoke, but it's not exactly a continuation, but it's looking at another aspect of what I spoke on last time. As you might recall, I was talking about a concept that I read about in a book by a doctor, Dr. Dweck, who proposed that a good way of looking at the way we think is through one of two mindsets. And I talked about this concept, and it makes a lot of sense to look at. You know, we can look at the mind in different ways, conscious, subconscious, intuitive, analytical, left brain, right brain, all kinds of things. But this was an interesting approach to think about the way we set, the fixed mindset. And it's a mentality that people have that basically you are what you are, that you really can't change much. You know, you're either dumb, smart, or somewhere in between, average, but you're not going to go from incredibly dumb to incredibly smart, that sort of thing. Just kind of where you're, you know, it's an athletic, but whatever the ability. You know, either you're a good athlete, a crummy athlete, or, you know, but wherever you are, you can move it a little. But you can't go from a spastic athlete to a Michael Jordan-type superstar. It's that kind of a concept. In other words, very fixed. And then the idea is that what happens when you have that kind of mindset is that your successes or failures tend to define you. You tend to go along to get along. You don't want to stand out from the crowd. You want to be kind of average. You don't want to appear dumb, you know, that sort of thing. You avoid being different. And so these are some of the things that that go to work when you have that kind of mindset. And we, all of us from time to time, get into a fixed mindset, but what I've emphasized last time is we need to be in a growth mindset. You know, in a growth mindset, your qualities are things that you can cultivate through your efforts. You know, the idea being that yeah, you may not be able to go from dumb to Einstein just through your efforts, but you can move that bar a long way through hard work, study, effort, those sort of things. And, you know, or grow. You change. And so we talked a lot about that growth mindset and all it entails. But I believe that there's perhaps another mindset that we need to look at. And this is not something that I read anywhere, but it just struck me that there is another mindset. To put a name on it, first I was thinking maybe of the self-esteem mindset, but I think that's probably a little tame, perhaps. And so I decided on the narcissistic mindset. And this mindset, your qualities are driven by your individual needs and desires with total disregard for what others may think of you or need from you. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about narcissism in a minute. But, as a matter of fact, that's what the sermon is going to be about. what is the narcissistic mindset, and how do you avoid it, basically? Because we see a lot of it around us these days. Now, I want to begin, though, by talking about, you know, it's kind of how we see things. Do you see things from a fixed mindset point of view? Do you see things from a growth mindset? Or you see things inwardly, the narcissistic mindset. And there was an interesting experiment that was conducted back in the 50s by a professor named Solomon Asch. And he came up with this experiment where he had two cards shown here. With lines. One card had a single vertical line on it. The other card had three vertical lines of differing lengths. And he numbered them 1, 2, and 3, as I've shown you here. And so what he did is he asked the he had some people come in, and he asked them a pretty simple question. He said, which of the three lines on the right, lines 1, 2, and 3, are the same length as the one on the card to the left? Sounds like a pretty simple question, doesn't it? Yeah, just looking at it, you could probably kind of say, yeah, I think I know the answer to that one. But here's the catch. The catch was that when Dr. Ashe brought in this group of 8 people, only one of them was the subject that was being tested. The other 7 were actors. They had been cued in beforehand about how to answer the question. And so we asked the question, and then he started pointing out to the different actors in the group and asking them which line was the same length. And they all picked line 2, which is obviously the wrong answer. It's a much longer line than the one on the left. But they all picked line 2. And then last he came to the subject and asked that individual, what do you think that individual said? He said, line 2. He said, line 2. And he went through this set with a series of, there were a series of 18 sequences similar to this. They weren't all the exact same thing, but similar kinds of things. He had them go through 18 sequences. And in 12 of those sequences, the actors all had been keyed in beforehand to give the wrong answer to the length of a line. 12 times out of 18, they were supposed to give the wrong answer. Then the other 6 times, they gave the right answer. But of the 12 times they gave the wrong answer, the subject agreed with them. Every single time, gave the wrong answer. When they interviewed him afterwards, they asked him about that. So, were you a little suspicious about the answers everybody was giving? And he said, yeah, on a couple of occasions, I kind of thought they were wrong, but I went along with the group. And he greatly underestimated just how far off he was in terms of giving his answers. You know, so there's this thing about kind of going along with the group, being influenced, and this test demonstrated that. I want to come back to this test a little bit later as I get into other things, but I want to take an example from the Bible to kind of start off here, because, you know, people, we see things differently, and that kind of influences our mindsets. And I want to use kind of as an object case the case of King Saul from the Old Testament. King Saul was chosen to be the first king of ancient Israel. And it's a complicated story that goes with it. It takes up a number of chapters in 1 Samuel. But I want to kind of begin at the almost at the ending as far as Saul's reign was concerned in 1 Samuel 15 and verse 17. Where Samuel is speaking to Saul, and Samuel said, "When you were little in your own eyes, you were not head were you not the head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel?" You know, so he's asked this question as a lead-in to telling Saul that God was removing him and his family line from the kings of Israel. And so he's pointing out Saul had a certain mindset, humility, but something changed along the way. Saul began to see things differently. Let's quickly kind of go through how Saul changed. For example, when God, you know, Israel wanted a king. Everybody, all the nations around them had kings. Israel wanted a king. We need a king. So finally, they said, Sam, you're getting old. You're going to die soon. We need a king. And so God said, okay, Samuel, we'll give him a king. And so they went about picking a king, and God did. And it's kind of a long, meandering story in the sense there in around 1 Samuel 9, that some of the donkeys wandered off from Samuel's farm, and his father sent him out with a servant to find the donkeys. And they wandered for several days and finally ended up in the city where Samuel was. And they asked Samuel, "Have you seen our donkeys?" And Samuel said, "Look, all this is God's plan to bring you to me because something's going on." And he at this point, he began to explain to Saul what God had in mind. And in verses 1 Samuel 9, 21, Saul answered and said, Saul answered and said, "Am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribes of Benjamin? Why then do you speak like this to me?" You see, there was this really humble attitude that Saul had. And so we move on down to verse 27 of 1 Samuel 9. They went into and had a dinner, and Saul spent the night with Samuel, and the next morning Samuel's leaving. And so in verse 27 of 1 Samuel 9, "Now as they were going down to the outskirts of the city, Samuel said to Saul, 'Tell the servant to go on ahead of us.' And the servant went on, 'But you stand here a while that I may announce to you the word of God.'" So here, then, Samuel is explaining God's plan, that Saul is going to be king. Now we move on to chapter 10 of 1 Samuel, verses 6 through 9. We see that Samuel was going to be king. He was anointed. Samuel anointed Saul. Right shortly after that, in 1 Samuel 10, verse 6, "Then the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you, and you will prophesy with them, with the other prophets he's referring to, and be turned into another man." You are going to be changed. Turns out the change wasn't as good as you might have hoped, or as God might have hoped, for that matter. And let it be, when these signs come to you, that you do as the occasion demands, for God is with you. You shall go down before me to Gilgal, and surely I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and make sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days you shall wait till I come to you and show you what you should do." And Saul waited the 7 days. He didn't try to tell you. Remember, later on, he didn't wait. We'll look at that in just a minute. But he waited patiently for Samuel to show up. And then in verse 27 of 1 Samuel 10, Saul also went home to Gibeah, and the valiant men went with him, whose hearts God had turned. And so God wasn't leaving Saul just kind of hanging out on the limb. The powerful men in Israel, typically in most countries, is the army back in that day. And God turned the hearts of some of the valiant men to support Saul. They were, God was giving Saul a lot of help. But there were some rebels, and the rebels said, "How can this man save us?" So they despised him and brought him no presents. But he held his peace. See, Saul didn't react to that. He could have reacted and arrested those people or taken some action. He didn't. He just held his peace. He was a humble guy. But then we move on to 1 Samuel 11, 6. Now, they were having some problem with the Amorites at this time. The Amorites were threatening a city. They were going to basically blind all the people if they didn't surrender. The word came to Samuel. And then in chapter 11, verse 6, "Then the Spirit of God came to Saul. When he heard about this news, his anger was greatly aroused." So God's Spirit was working with Saul. And he took charge and he defeated the Amorites and solved that problem. And when he did, 1 Samuel 11, verses 12 and 13, "Then the people said to Samuel, 'Who is he who says, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death.' Now, the people saw that God was working with Saul. They were very excited, and there were some dissenters, some rebels. Let's kill them all. But Saul said, not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished salvation in Israel. And you can see Saul was had the right mindset. He was growing into his position. Something happened. 2 years later, 1 Samuel 13, verses 8 and 9. Again, Samuel had told Saul to go wait 7 days, he would be there and meet with him. Saul waited 7 days, according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering, usurping the priest. And that was his downfall. Something had happened over a 2 year period. Now, suddenly, Saul was the man. And it was just a couple of years later. And all that had changed dramatically. In 1 Samuel 14, verse 24, the other group that was a thorn in the side of the Israelites at that time were the Philistines. And so there was the Philistines that were uprising. And there was constant skirmishes and battles with the Philistines. And so there was this battle going on with the Philistines in 1 Samuel 14, 24, and the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under oath, saying, cursed is the man who eats any food until evening, before I have taken vengeance on my enemies. So none of the people tasted food. So here in the middle of battle, and he says, nobody's going to eat any food until we beat these guys. But notice the way he said that. He didn't say, until God brings us the victory, as he had talked about in the past, as we saw. But instead he says, before I have taken vengeance on my enemies. See the change there. Now, why would Saul tell the Israelite soldiers not to eat? That would put them in a weakened state. Was this some idea of motivation? Wouldn't a better motivation have been to point out that God will be with them rather than telling them not to eat? See, it was now Saul, not God, taking vengeance. Saul was the man. You know, so from a humble, learning, growing, he became inward. I'm the man. I'm the king here. I'm the important one. Self-esteem began to build, leading into narcissism eventually. 1 Samuel 14, verse 43, there was a problem here because he said that, because his son Jonathan didn't know about that. So in verse 43, then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. And Jonathan told him and said, I only tasted a little bit of honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand. So now I must die. And Saul answered, God do so and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. But the people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die? Who has accomplished this great salvation in Israel? Jonathan had led the battle and basically destroyed the big Philistine garrison. Certainly not. As the Lord lives, not one hair on his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. And so the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. So Saul just kind of said, okay, he's my son. I guess we'll let him live for the time being. But you can see Saul had changed. And then in 1 Samuel 16 and verse 4, but the spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. He'd been told he was going to not be king, but he hadn't been removed from the throne yet. But it was only a matter of time, God's timing. And so now he was in big trouble, and he began to see who might replace him. which was David. Then 1 Samuel 18, verse 8. Then Saul was very angry and the saying displeased him, and he said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands." Now, what more can he have but the kingdom? So Saul eyed David from that day forward, and he went on to plot his murder and to get rid of him and solve the problem. So you see this complete change in Saul. Of course, David did take over the throne. David had a different mindset. We won't go through all the history, and everyone's familiar with a lot about David's life. But, he was strong. From lions to bears to Goliath, he had that kind of physical strength. He was a talented musician, a harpist. He was a psalmist. We got a lot of psalms that have been recorded in the Bible that he wrote. He was a prophet. He was inspired by God in many ways. And he built the kingdom of Israel up until it extended from Egypt up to Turkey. The largest amount of land that Israel ever controlled was during the days of David and then his son Solomon. And he built all that up. And yet, when he messed up, he admitted his sins and repented. Now, David was always, you might say, stretching himself, pushing ahead, making some mistakes, but not afraid of failure in the sense that if he messed up, he'd repent, learn from it, and continue on. And he did that through his entire life. You know, finally, when he was old and dying, what was he doing? He was gathering materials to build the temple. God said, "You can't build this temple. You've got blood on your hands." David said, "Okay, well, I can't build it, but at least I can get the materials together so that my son can." See, that kind of mindset is very different. All right, with that background, in terms of the different mindsets, let me ask you a question. Give me a short one-sentence answer. What is God's plan? What's the plan of God? Now, I suspect that most of you are thinking in terms of a short, quick answer, something along these lines: to enlarge his spiritual family. Isn't that what God's plan boils down to? He's calling people. At some point, those he has called will be resurrected into spiritual form and will become a part of his family. And so, to enlarge his family. Okay, second question. What is the plan of Satan? Isn't it to enlarge his physical dominion? God wants to enlarge his spiritual family. Satan basically wants to crush that spiritual family and have dominion, while they're still physical, have dominion over them. You know, and it's two very different approaches. God gives us a choice. Deuteronomy 30 and verse 19, "I call heaven and earth." Now, he's saying this to the ancient Israelites, but the principle has extended to us this very day. "I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both you and your descendants may live." Now, so he sets that choice before us. But what about Satan? You know, what is Satan? What does Satan do? You know, Satan takes away our choice. How? Through deception. He deceives us. So we don't have a true choice. We have false choices. We're deceived into making those kind of things. Revelation 12 and verse 9. "So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." Now, he's the great deceiver. And he was cast out to this earth. Now, the scriptures show that God has given him temporary control over the earth. Of course, subject to limitation God puts on him. But he's the god of this world, is what the scripture basically tells us. In Ezekiel 28, verse 17, we read about the fall of Satan and what happened. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. Satan was all about himself. And you might say he was the original narcissistic mindset. That was Satan. And he would like to see us the same way. Now, the path to narcissism begins with self-esteem. Self-esteem, if you look it up in the dictionary, you'll see a definition along these lines. A confidence and satisfaction in oneself. And, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, that you get satisfaction and have some confidence in your own abilities and so forth. That's not necessarily bad, but it can be. Especially if it leads into pride, which you might find a definition in a dictionary along the lines of pride being inordinate self-esteem. Now you're going past just, okay, yeah, it's good to have success here and there and do things, but inordinate self-esteem, I'm the greatest, that sort of thing. But then if you go a little bit further, narcissism is undue dwelling on one's own self or attainments. It's the next step up. And so that's what we're talking about, and that's the problem. Self-esteem, you know, you can grow in the wrong direction. Self-esteem to pride to narcissism. And it seems like much of society is heading in that direction. Now, I read another book a while back by a professor. Her name was Jean Twenge, T-W-E-N-G-E, was her name. And the title of the book was Generation Me. Now, I found it interesting from this viewpoint, probably because I'm an engineer. And you know us engineers, we like data. We like data. And her area, she's a college professor, and her area of research is in looking at the comparisons of different generations, how the generations have changed. And so she had tons of research data there, and most of it came from certain groups of people. Now, yeah, and when you're talking about attitudes and things of this nature, things sociologists look at, they take surveys. That's how they get their data. They take surveys. Now, I don't know about you, but I get telephone calls from time to time wanting me to do a survey. And I usually just, nah, I'm not interested. Nobody likes to fool with surveys. It's just time consuming, and you know, not really care about the subject and so forth. And you probably run into the same sort of thing. But there are two groups of people who can't just blow off a survey. Two groups. You know who they are? High school students and college students. They can't just blow it off because it's an assignment. And so going back to, really it began after World War II, that the sociologists have been going out and doing these massive surveys of the attitudes of high school students and college students. And I say massive, I don't mean surveys of 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000, something like that you see in a lot of these political polls. They'll view a couple thousand people and draw conclusions. These are like 50,000, 100,000, multiple hundreds of thousands. And they began after World War II. And the focus has always been on high school age, college age people. And so by looking at the data for the same questions that were asked in the 50s, that were asked in the 60s, 70s, 80s, right on up to the current time, the same general questions were asked to people when they were at the same age. And so you can say, well, how are generations changing in the way they think? And so that was what made the book kind of interesting to me. And so she found that the current generation, which she calls Generation Me, a more common name perhaps these days is Generation Y or the Millennials. Basically those born, and it's kind of a rough measure, between about 1982 and 1999, they're now getting on up into young adulthood, basically. A good many of them are. She calls that Generation Me, because they look much differently at things than previous generations. Now, the previous generation has been referred to as Generation X, and that goes back to, from the 60s to the early 80s, that period of time. And then that was preceded by the baby boomers. That goes from 43 to 60. How many baby boomers do we have in here? Quite a few. How many Gen X's do we have in here? Millennials? Yeah, we got a cross section here. And then there's the greatest generation. I just made it into the greatest generation. From 1920 to 42, I was born in 1941. Almost at the end of now, but 2 months later, I'd have been in the baby boomers. Instead, I just happened to be in the greatest generation. Of course, these names get put on things later on. You know, the greatest generation never thought of themselves as the greatest generation. But, you know, this is one way of kind of dividing up, because there are trends that seem to change from each of these generations. And it shows up because they begin surveying, massive surveys of all kinds of things, when each of these generations were in high school and college. And so let's, what I'm going to say is that we're seeing a move towards a narcissistic mindset with each generation as it has progressed. So let's look at what that mindset may look like. Okay. And I'm talking about now the millennials. You know, who raised their hands? Millennials? I'm talking to y'all. You know, the young adults. We're not talking about young adults, basically. Here's what we're talking about. And here's what Dr. Twenge said is probably why this generation is different. The millennials, or the Generation Me, as she calls them. First of all, and she's talking about the United States primarily, not the world necessarily, although the Western culture is all moving in the same direction. But, you know, it's the most wanted generation, she suggests, in American history. And the reason she says that is because of birth control, legalized abortion, and the cultural shift towards smaller families, towards parents having a choice of, you know, you go back 100 years or so, children just happened, and they happened all the time. Back years ago when I was in Atlanta, and there was a friend of ours who, was it eight children? They had eight children. And he would laughingly say, if I could only figure out what was causing, I'd stop having them. He was a funny guy. But, you know, but everybody, back, you go back 100 years or so, back when I was just finished an undergraduate degree, I went up to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, to intern up there with Bethlehem Steel. And we lived in this kind of old Catholic neighborhood. Everybody had six, seven, eight children. There were kids all over the place. You know, so used to, kids just happened. Now, how many kids do people have? Yeah. On the average, two. Two and a half or something like that. I'm not sure about the half. But you know, the birth, the number of children being born has dropped dramatically in the United States, as well as many other Western countries. So now people have a child, it's because they, okay, we really want this child. And so what happens? The child becomes a prized possession. You know, like this same guy I was talking about. He said when one of his children gets out of line, you know, no, that wasn't him. It was, who was it? I think it was Bill Cosby. He said he used to tell his kids when one gets out of line, he said, oh, I can get rid of you because I can make another one just like that. You know, but now children have become more and more of a prized possession because you don't have many. And so what happens, and it begins very early with parents, and then in schools in particular, they're taught from the time they enter kindergarten how special they are, right on through college. And they're not so much self-absorbed, they feel self-important. And you see it in the media, you see it everywhere, and they believe they should follow their dreams and not be held back by societal expectations. This is kind of a trend. They're consistently taught to put their own needs first and to focus on feeling good about themselves. You know, that's kind of the mindset that the millennial generation has seen since the day they were born. Now, compare that to the attitude of the greatest generation, young people in the greatest generation, back when they were young. Duty, responsibility was more important than individual needs. You dressed in certain ways. ever watched the old film of baseball games back in the 40s and 50s? What did the guys wear? Suits, a vest, a hat. That's the way you attended a sporting event. And everybody did it. You know, it's funny to see these old films because they all are dressed exactly the same way. Well, you don't see people dressed exactly the same way now. They're all bummy looking, but you don't, you know, they all dress differently. But, you know, but back then you dressed in certain ways. You did certain things. You said certain things. You know, there was a certain behavior in the way you acted, the way you spoke. You didn't talk about certain things. You know, certainly you would not use foul language, vulgar language, in front of a female if you were male. Now, that was the mindset back then. What about the attitude of Generation Me, the more narcissistic mindset? Well, it was driven by their individual needs and desires. It's a me-first kind of attitude. But it's not necessarily their fault because that's all they've been told. They've been told to follow their dreams, have been taught to pursue happiness above all else. It's okay to be different. Don't worry about what others think. Do what's right for you. Just be yourself. Live life according to morals, views, and standards that you create. And as a result of these kind of things, only about they're only half as likely as those, even back to just to the 80s, to believe that children should learn obedience above all else. Now, they don't believe that. I don't know how many of you like the comic strips. I kind of like certain comic strips. I like Dilbert. Dilbert's an engineer. Maybe that's why I like him. And he's in the management thing. But there was a comic strip yesterday, a Dilbert comic strip, that ties in with this. And so I thought I would show it to you. The subtitle there is The Entitled Employer, if you can read that. Since people are getting this on tape, I'll read it too. This is obviously a millennial. He said, "Did you finish your assignment for the project?" Dilbert asked him, and he replies, "No, I was tired, and it looked hard." And then he says in the last frame, "I assume someone does that hard stuff for me. Am I wrong?" And Dilbert replies, "I need to have a word with your parents." I thought that was that expresses kind of the millennial mindset. And so I thought that tied in good. Now, I want to go back I mentioned this this Atch experiment, the straight lines, and who thought that who went along with the crowd. Well, once he did this first experiment, he did some more. He got interested in, well, is this just one guy or is it more? And so back then in 51, he did a number of these experiments, the same kind of thing, to see who would follow along with the group, even though it was obviously a wrong answer. And what he found was that in a number of different tests with a number of different people, that 74% gave the group's incorrect answer on at least one of the trials, and that 28% did on the majority of the trials. So this was back in 51. And let's jump down to the 80s. They did the same kind of test. Nobody followed the group anymore. Everybody was completely independent. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it shows that there's a different way of thinking. Now, this groupthink, as it's often referred to, is different now than it was back in the 50s, certainly. Now, in 1924, and that goes back a long ways, there was a study on the important traits in children. And the things that were listed as most important were strict obedience, loyalty to the church, and good manners. A similar kind of study in 1988, the important traits in children were independence and tolerance. Really a big change there in what children are being taught. So let's think about self-esteem here for a minute. You're taught to put yourself, they were taught to put themselves first when they were small. I'm talking about the millennials now again. They move through the world beholden to few social rules and with an unshakable belief that they are important. Their common sense advice. Now here's the advice that they've been given. And I'm just going to list a few of these. Just be yourself. If you believe in yourself, anything is possible. You have to express yourself. You have to respect yourself. Be honest with yourself. You have to love yourself first before you can love someone else. Now, when they do surveys, these are the kind of responses millennials give, this sort of thing. So let's dissect these a little bit. Let's dissect these. Just be yourself. Well, sounds good. Just be yourself. Unless you're selfish. Unless you're crude and vulgar, unless you're a thief or a serial killer, just be yourself? Yeah, when you really start dissecting, it doesn't make any sense, just be yourself. It just makes very little sense. And yet, that's kind of a philosophy these days among the youth culture. And it shows up in the attitudes towards morality. And it's this kind of general thing. Everyone has their own moral view, and it's not right to question someone else's view. Now, what happens when you start questioning someone's view? Well, it depends on the subject. But you're a bigot. You're insensitive. You're a racist. You know, they'll call you some name, depending on what the subject matter is, if you question any view. You know, you're prejudiced if you don't support this thing, that thing, gay marriage, whatever. They'll tag you with a name. This generation is very accepting of this philosophy. Live and let die. There's some studies that show, particularly in the millennials, when they're tested in this area, and ask questions like, if somebody's in trouble, do you feel obligated to go help or something like that? Most of them say no. They're on their own. I don't have any obligation to that. That's a different attitude. They're unaware of any source of moral reasoning outside themselves. Make up their own moral values, which means they don't have much in the way of moral values. And here's some statistics from a study of 25,000 high school students back in 2012. 57% agreed with this statement. In the real world, successful people do what they have to do to win, even if others consider it cheating. And that's the way the question is right. Even if others consider it cheating, like you wouldn't consider it cheating, because you set your own moral standards. Now here, I'll show you a graph here. This is a graph of one of these massive studies that were taken about cheating in high school. And shown here are data from 69, 92, 2002, and 2012. And it's the percent that basically said they cheated in high school. And you can see it was up around 34%, about a third said they cheated in high school back in the 60s. It went up to 61% in 92, to 74% in 02, and it dropped back down a little bit, 51% in 12, but still very high. Now, moral standards have changed. And this is just the opposite of what God teaches. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 24. Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. Now, that's what God says. Matthew 23, verse 25. And he's talking specifically about scribes and Pharisees here, but there's a principle involved. What are you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites? For you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Self-indulgence. Now, Christ was very critical of the scribes and Pharisees, the religious leaders of his day, because they had this narcissistic mindset. It was all about them. And everything was about them. You know, that whole chapter 23 of Matthew, just boom, 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 on that group of religious leaders. You know, look at another one of the comments that we looked at. If you believe in yourself, anything is possible. Sounds great. I'm inspired. If I believe in myself, I can do anything. Can you? If you can anyone be a great singer? Could you be a great singer? Could you be a great musician? Could you be the next prince? You know, could you be the next great superstar? Could you be the next LeBron James? Is it possible that you could arrive at that level? Well, probably not. By and large, most people, it's simply not possible that you could reach that level. How about Olympic champion? You know, it sounds good when you say there are limits to what you can do. You know, our natural abilities, if you're an athlete, your natural abilities can take you to a certain point. But you're never going to be, no matter how much you practice and train and dedicate, you're never going to be a Usain Bolt, the fastest man in the world. I don't think anybody here could ever do that. Most of us, there are things that are simply impossible. Now, let's look at this graph. If you will you go to graduate school? This question was asked of college freshmen back in 76 and 2012. Will you go to graduate school? In other words, you know, will you strive and get a higher education than even just college? Back in 76, 20% of the freshmen said, yeah, I'm going to graduate school. By 2012, nearly 60% said, yeah, I'm going to graduate school. You know how many actually went to graduate school? And it was almost a constant from 1976 all the way up to 2012, around 9%. And everybody said, oh boy, all I have to do is believe. You have to do a lot more than believe if you're going somewhere. But this mindset of, boy, yeah, I believe I'll go to graduate school. It'll happen. It takes hard work. It takes studying. It takes dedication. It takes throwing yourself into whatever you want to do to be successful. And even then, you may not make it to the top. There are limits. But you can grow. And you can change. Another question in the 76 and 2012 freshman college class. Do you expect to work in professional or management field? 40% in 76 said yes. Almost 70% in 2012 said yes. But what actually happens? About 20% of college graduates end up in management fields. And it's been pretty much a constant since the 70s. You know, so a lot of people have the vision, but accomplishing it is something else entirely. And you know, when you think about it, just believing in something is enough. Look at Jeremiah 46 and verse 16. Now this is talking about the Edom, who is Esau's descendants. But it's a general principle here. You know, they were soldiers, they were fighters. It says, your fierceness has deceived you. The pride of your heart. You know, there it is, the pride of your heart, that self-esteem. O you who dwell in the clefts of the rock, who hold the height of the hill, though you make your nest as high as an eagle, I will bring you down from there, says the Lord. Yeah, that pride, self-esteem, you know, lifting yourself up like that is simply not going to work. Again, we're talking about the complete opposite from what God teaches. Luke 13, verse 24. Strive to enter through the narrow gate, for many, I say to you, will seek to enter and will not be able. That word strive, work. In Matthew 11, verse 12. And from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take it by force. In other words, the forceful. That word violent is really means forceful. The forceful is something you have to work at. And again, what is the world? What does traditional Christianity teach? Believe. Just believe. Just believe and you're in. Believe that Jesus Christ died for your sins. That's it. Don't have to change the way you live. Don't have to do anything. Just believe. And that's the kind of thing that millennials are buying into now as they mature and move into the world, out of college and into the world. That's what they're buying into. Mark 10 and verse 27. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying to themselves, who then can be saved? But looking at them, Jesus said, with men it is impossible. With men, certain things simply are impossible. But with God... But not with God, for with God all things are possible. You want to talk about possible and impossible. If you're doing it on your own, there are certain things simply not possible. But with God's help, there isn't really much of a limit on what you can do. But of course, he's talking mainly about being in God's kingdom, being a part of God's family. He's not talking about whether you're going to be Olympic champion or not. Sadly, my dream of being Olympic champion faded years ago. But, you know, we have to give up on some of our dreams, even though I believed. You You know, basically, this millennial generation, they believe that the key to success is not hard work involving the family, good teachers, years of study, but just believing in yourself. Just believe in yourself. You know, when you reach around 25, 30, and that sort of thing, and you're totally dissatisfied with your life, then you have to ask yourself, how's that believing in yourself business working? You should be believing in something else, what God teaches. Express yourself. Again, self-focus, express yourself. Now, there's something that sociologists define as agency, and this is just a term that describes a personality trait involving assertiveness, dominion, independence, and self-promotion. So agency is kind of a term they use to say yourself, those kind of things. Now, test on nearly 80,000 high school and college students on this thing called agency. The average 90s student scored 75% higher than the average 70 student on these things like assertiveness, dominance, independence, and self-promotion. 75% higher. A study of college students' belief about their abilities from 66 to 2012, that generation me, this more recent generation, the millennials, students believe they were above average in leadership, drive, and intelligence, and intellectual self-confidence. They believe we're much better, higher average than that. But they didn't think they were particularly above average in cooperativeness or understanding of others. That wasn't important to them. But, you think about it. You know, we're given so many choices. Kids growing up, everything's a choice. You know, even little first graders, parents will let them pick their clothes out, no matter how mismatched or whatever else they are, to wear to school and that sort of thing. And they think they're entitled to that. I've got a second-grade granddaughter who's kind of like that. She thinks she's a fashionista, and she knows what looks good. And so there's these squabbles with her mother about things to wear. And it carries over to, they stay at our house a lot, and I like to get them out, and we'll get out and do sports and stuff. And they kept showing up in dresses, especially the little one. The 10-year-old was a little, she didn't care a thing about how she dresses. But the 7-year-old shows up in dresses, and we're going to go outside and play, do things. And finally, I had to lay down the law. I said, well, I'm not keeping you if you show up in a dress. So we're going to do things. She's trying to ride a bicycle in a dress, things like that. So, but that's the way they are. And, parents let them choose whether to do their homework or not, whether to practice a musical instrument if they're in a band or in a sport, whether to go to practice or not. And they're afraid to discipline because it might break their spirit. I don't know about you, but I was disciplined pretty hard. I don't think it ever broke my spirit. But that's the thinking. And here's a big one. You must love yourself before you can love others. You must love yourself before you can love others. What do you think about that one? If you truly don't care about what anybody else thinks, if you truly just love yourself and, forget everybody else, you're probably not going to be good relationship material, so you're probably not going to get married anyway. Nobody's going to want you if you have that kind of attitude. But let's look at some data here. This is a survey that's been asked over the years, again, for mainly college students in this case, about 25,000 across the country. And the question was of do they have negative views of others? 10% said yes in 88. In 2011, 32% said yes. They had negative views of others. Now, this is the fact that you just love yourself. Don't forget others and that sort of thing. And year after year, study after study, right up to the present time, they show that people who have good relationships are the happiest. If you have a good relationship, you score the highest in happiness. It's not if you make the most money or you have the most job satisfaction. It's the good relationships that put you at the top in terms of happiness. Study after study for generations, including now, show the same thing. Okay, this whole idea, you must love yourself before you can love others. If you compare to previous generations, the younger generation experienced a 42% greater drop in marital satisfaction after having children. You're not as happy in this generation after you have children as previous generations were. This is a comparison of generations. 42% greater drop in happiness for couples who are married, and this was 47,000 couples involved in this survey. What's going on? Are children that bad? Well, could it be that parenthood requires a radical shift away from the self? All of a sudden, you have to start thinking about somebody else. And if you've been trained your entire life to think about yourself, and now all of a sudden you have all these responsibilities, that's a hard step to take. And you may be unhappy for a while unless you learn. And then there's all these obsessions that people have because they love themselves. The appearance obsession. Plastic surgery. You know, before the millennials came along, there wasn't a word called a selfie. Now it is the word. Selfies. As I saw a cartoon a while back, somebody saying, "This is a selfie I took. You can't see it, but back in the background is the Grand Canyon." You know, it's that kind of attitude these days. Tattoos and piercings. You know, people didn't used to get, pierced ears is one thing, but you know, all these piercings and tattoos all over the body. You know, that is so different. Now, you know, begin as an appearance obsession. I'm me, and I'm defined by this, that, or the other. My 10-year-old granddaughter came bouncing into the house yesterday, the day before yesterday, and look at me. And I looked at her, and she looked about the same as she always did. And said, my ears, she had gotten her ears pierced. And I said, okay, well, I guess that's okay. And asked her if they were sore and everything. But then she said this. I also have a 20-year-old granddaughter who lives in Orlando named Mackenzie. And she said, and soon I'm going to get a tattoo just like my cousin Mackenzie. Oh, no. Here we go. Because Mackenzie is a true millennial in many ways. And so she's had some piercings, some tattoos. I said, no, you don't want to do that. But I'm not sure she's going to listen to Grandpa. But, you know, it's this focus on the self. And, of course, materialism. So much of everything is materialism these days. But, again, just the opposite of what the Bible teaches. Matthew 22:37, very famous verses. Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." And there it is. That's all of it. Then there's the attitude towards authority. They don't just question authority, but they disregard it entirely. There was a recent survey of college faculty that 61% of the faculty across the country reported they'd been verbally disrespected or challenged during class. Now, I never had that problem when I was teaching, because it's kind of hard to argue with a number. And in engineering courses, we produce numbers. And there's only one right number. And you can't argue with it, although some have tried occasionally. But so I never saw much of that when I was teaching in college. But you get into the humanities, the liberal arts, and I heard other faculty members that I knew in some of those areas talking about some of the things that went on. They get challenged, verbally abused. And, you know, with YouTube and stuff like that, you see these things going on down in the lower elementary schools, fights breaking out and stuff like that, people attacking a teacher, things of this nature. Yeah, you never used to see that sort of thing towards authority. But it's an entirely different attitude. You know, the Internet has become the authority. There's some commercial, I forget what it's about. Say, well, it's on the Internet, it must be true. And parents now share authority with their children. Very different. Then there's the attitude towards marriage. It's now personal choice. In 2012, 41% of all babies born in the U.S. were born to unmarried women, compared to 5% in 1960. You've heard some of these statistics before, but I'll just run through a couple of them here. 39% of cohabitating couples with children break up within the first 5 years of a child's life, compared to 13% of those married. Now, you have three times a better chance that a marriage will succeed, at least for 5 years, if you're married, rather than just living together. Religion is certainly no issue concerning marriage anymore. Rarely comes up. And then there's the attitude towards religion. And they're called the nuns, not the N-U-N-S nuns, but the N-O-N-E-S nuns, meaning they have, when they ask for a religious affiliation, you check the box that says nun. So the nuns entering college tripled between 83 and 2012. They went from 8% to 24%. The nuns between 18 and 29 tripled since 72. They went up to 30% now. When asked the reason why teenagers and young adults have moved away from religion, the most common answer is intellectual skepticism, which is not surprising. The emphasis you get in school, particularly things related to God, God is not taught in school. Principles of God are not taught in school. Evolution is taught in school. All this is going on, and it's changing a generation. Nearly four times as many Americans in their 30s claim no religious affiliation in 2012 compared to 1972. Among people 18 to 29 years old that were surveyed in 94, only 2% never prayed. By 12, it was 26% never prayed. Again, a reflection of the same thing. Then, look at 2 Timothy, and this is what I want to conclude with here. 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 to 5. I want you to, this is a scripture you read through and just kind of go through it real fast. But look, from what I've talked about today, look at how many of these things are basically talking about the narcissistic mindset. But know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. For men will become lovers of themselves. Check. Lovers of money. Check. Boasters. Check. Proud. Check. Blasphemers. Have you heard the language that kids use these days? Check. Disobedient to parents. Check. Unthankful. Check. Unholy. Unloving. Unforgiving. Slanderous. Without self-control. Check, check, check. Brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Check, check. Having a form of godliness but denying his power. They may go to church. God's not really a part of most people's lives. And from such people turn away. See, this is what Satan wants you to do. Be like him. Have a narcissistic mindset. What are you doing in your mind to avoid falling into the trap of the narcissistic mindset?